Welcome back, everyone, to our afternoon session. So we're very lucky to have Katerina Hajiwano here from Caltech. So she's going to lead a discussion on matter in extreme conditions. After that, we're going to have a bit of a discussion on both Katerina's talk and some other topics. You can look on the slide deck again to see some topics. Please add. We'll then break for coffee, and then we'll come back and have some more discussion. And we can, you know, circle back to more questions from this morning, but really just, you know, keep them coming. It's great to have such a lively discussion. So with that, thank you, Katerina, for coming, and please take it away.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, everyone. And thanks for organizing what is probably for a lot of us first in-person workshop. It's good to see you after all those years. Okay, so I was asked to talk about matter in extreme conditions, and I ended up doing something that's slightly less of an overview of the problem we were trying to solve and more focus on what are the open questions, or at least in my mind, moving forward, what are the things that make me more worried. So let's start simple. This is, of course, the masses in the stellar graveyard plot, and the vast majority of the objects we observe with gravitational waves are the ones in blue, the black holes, because they're more massive, we're more sensitive to them. The discussion here, of course, what happens more at the lower side. So the x-axis is the mass, and we're talking about masses 1 to 5. So there are a lot of things we don't know about what happens there. There are a lot of things we assume, and I would like to point out the things that we assume, whether you believe they're established or not. But something that is sort of well established in this low mass region, even if you don't agree on exactly the number I wrote there, there has to be some threshold above which you can no longer have neutron stars. And usually the number is considered to be something like 3.2 solar masses. So that's something we know. Above a certain threshold, the objects we observe cannot be neutron stars. They have to be black holes. We also have some sort of tentative observational evidence from electromagnetic observations about a low mass gap, a gap between the lightest black hole and the heaviest neutron star, observed again electromagnetically. There are some ideas about objects that could be in the mass gap. Lately, two or three of those were killed. They're not compact objects in the mass gap. There are a lot of claims about those things. Some of them, though, still survive. But there seems to be a kind of underdensity of objects in there. So what we're going to talk about is the objects you observe with gravitational waves, so the orange-ish ones. And we'll be talking about what their properties are. Remember, above 3.2 solar masses, we know what those objects are. Below 3.2 solar masses, we don't know, technically, if you want to be fully agnostic and flexible, we actually don't really know what those objects are and what their properties are. So just the way I like picturing this in my mind, there are four things that are different, are qualitatively different between neutron stars and black holes. And I listed them here as four things, but these are not independent. They're very interconnecting. They're hard to interpret. But roughly speaking, we differentiate between neutron stars and black holes based on their masses, based on whether we have finite size effects, based on whether there's an electromagnetic counterpart to the gravitational wave observation, and also based on what kind of object is formed after the merger. I will mostly talk about the first two here. I will briefly touch upon the electromagnetic counterpart and the merger remnant, but I will mostly be talking about the first two because these are the ones where gravitational waves mostly come in. Okay, so some assumptions. Let's talk about component masses. There's certain things we're sure of, and there's certain things we commonly assume. So we know that neutron stars can go up to 2 solar masses. We have observations, electromagnetic observations, of 2 solar mass objects that are definitely pulsars. I've already mentioned this, anything above about 3.2 is a black hole, though the 3.2 number maybe take it with a grain of salt. And galactic neutron stars in binaries cluster quite tightly around masses of about 1.35 solar masses. That's actually true for neutron stars in general, galactic neutron stars, not even in binaries. They mostly cluster around 1.3 solar masses, 1.4, but they have a wider spread than neutron stars in binaries. And there are certain things that we sort of assume that, first of all, that there's a clean separation between neutron stars and black holes. The lightest black hole is more massive than the heaviest neutron star. We don't know if that's actually true, but it's a common assumption. Related to that, astrophysical black holes cannot go below two solar masses. If the formation origin of those objects is through solar evolution and supernova explosions, then they are cleanly separated, neutron stars and black holes. And neutron stars are usually masses above one. And one is probably a bit conservative here, more like 1.1, 1.2. Okay, so these are things that we know or assume. And same thing about the other three criteria. With finite size effects, a thing we commonly assume is a theoretical assumption that black holes do not have finite size effects. And I should clarify here, I'll talk a little bit more about finite size effects. But I should clarify what I mean here by finite size effect is an observable effect on the waveform at infinity from tidal interactions. So let's not get into an argument about whether black hole horizons are distorted. What I care about here is whether there's an input on the waveform about this. And then electromagnetic counterparts, we, of course, trivially, if there is an electromagnetic emission, there's some matter, at least one neutron star in the system. But also, we commonly assume and try to find relations between the electromagnetic signal and the binary parameters, which brings us squarely into the regime of numerical simulations and how much you trust them in systematics. And kind of similar for the merger remnant. If there's a neutron star merger remnant, of course, immediately we know that this was a neutron star binary. You can't form a neutron star from a black hole. But also we try to play the same game of linking the initial condition, which is the binary in its merger, to the remnant and its properties, which then in turn gives the initial conditions for the electromagnetic counterpart. And again, that brings us from qualitative understanding to quantitative relations that are subject to systematic have to be calibrated by simulations. Okay, so this is the landscape, the main things that I will be talking about. And the first and foremost, of course, is the masses. So here is the mass of 2W170817. Two masses because you have two binary components computed after two different assumptions for the spin. A recurring theme here is going to be that spin matters. And spin is also relatively unmeasurable with today's sensitivity. So it's not just that spin matters, but also whatever your prior assumptions on the spin distribution will matter, will affect your results quite sensitively in many cases. For the record, there's also a conversion between the spin of a neutron star and the period of a pulsar. So 1 millisecond pulsar will have a spin of about 0.4, so a pretty highly spinning neutron star. But okay, so this is what we measure. We've seen this plot before. We're very used to this. We know that chirp mass is very well measured. The mass ratio is less well measured, and now you end up having quite some dependence on assumptions about the spin. But when all is said and done, no matter what your uncertainties are and how you treat the spin, it's pretty hard to deny the fact that 170817 is perfectly consistent with galactic binaries. So nobody, even from the gravitational wave data, ignoring the electromagnetic counterpart, had any problem calling it a neutron star binary. Okay, next thing is tidal interactions. And here, you have the standard theory of tidal interactions. When you put an object, a finite size object that's not a black hole, in an external field, it will grow a quadrupole moment, which will affect the binary evolution because the extra quadrupole moment, draws energy, binding energy from the system in order to form. And second, because you have a quadrupole moment, you keep emitting more gravitational waves. So what happens here is we have this effect happening twice. Each star creates a tidal field, a gravitational tidal field, which induces a quadruple moment on its companion. And that constant of proportionality is what we are typically working with. It's called the tidal deformability. And it tells you how much deformable a star is. So if this parameter is large, this means the neutron stars are more fluffy, they're more big, so they are more easily distorted when put in an external field. And that's observable. So here's, for example, a gravitational wave signal shows what we measure with today's sensitivity. With today's sensitivity, we basically measure a speeding up in the phase evolution of the binary due to tidal interactions. Going forward, and we're going to discuss this a lot more, including tomorrow with Garant's talk, we might be able to see more effects, but today this is sort of what we're seeing. So if you look at the wave at the bottom panel, might be the best way to see it, and the frequency as a function of the frequency, so the wave and the frequency domain, for different values of the tides. So for zero, this is black holes, and then as you start increasing the magnitude of the tidal interactions, you'll see that the binary evolution proceeds faster. So if you look at the peaks of the waveform, it moves to the left as you increase the amount of tidal interactions, because you have larger, you have more quadruple, extra quadruple in your system, and the system loses energy more efficiently. Okay, for 17.0817, of course, we did that whole exercise. In practice, we only measure a single parameter. We don't measure the tidal parameters of both neutron stars very well, but regardless, it doesn't stop you from plotting constraints on the tidal parameters of the two bodies, lambda 1 and lambda 2. And there are different analyses, different assumptions in here to give you the three different results in three colors. But regardless, the main conclusion that seems to be a robust conclusion from across different analyses, across different waveforms, across different levels of systematics, is that the tidal interaction of 17.0817 was on the low side of what it could have been. So if you allow this entire region, it clusters at low values, which means it favors more compact neutron stars rather than more big, less compact neutron stars. And that's sort of the main thing that is fully robust from this analysis, that you put an upper limit on the amount of tidal interactions. Because going beyond that is actually hard, and here comes the spin again. So here is the plot for the tidal parameter, this lambda tilde, that is a combination of the tidal parameters that enters the waveform. When you analyze it under two assumptions for the spin, so the top is high spins and the bottom is low spins, again, robust conclusion that you put an upper limit, you push the amount of tidal interactions down. But if you actually want to go a step further and see what happens at the low side, whether you have any evidence for non-zero tidal interactions, that depends quite sensitively on what your spin assumptions are. And the spin is unmeasurable, so you have to make some spin assumptions. So what we wrote in that LVC paper, you can see the reference, was that if you assume low spins, you can exclude zero. The posterior moves away from zero, but if you don't assume low spins, allow for high spins, it's consistent with zero. So as far as the gravitational wave signal is concerned, even GW170817 is perfectly consistent with a pair of highly spinning black holes. Of course, I'm not proposing it was, because we have electromagnetic counterpart, but it is consistent with that, which gives you an indication, a first crack in this nice picture of we're going to use gravitational waves to understand all those systems. We can't even prove that 170817 was a neutron star binary, let alone what comes next. It was 1904-25, which was actually, I think, quite exciting on its own right. So here's the mass, this is the total mass for GW-1904-25 and other events. So in dashed, you have the galactic binaries. Remember I said that they have masses mostly around 1.3, so the total mass is around 1.75 or so. 170817 first squarely in this range. It was perfectly consistent with this range, but 1904-25 is not. Again, depending on what you assume about the spins, you get the orange and the blue for the total mass, which is completely inconsistent with the galactic population. The individual objects in the binary are consistent with neutron stars. They had mass around 1.8 with large uncertainty, sure, but 1.8, which is consistent with neutron star observations, but is inconsistent with any neutron star in a neutron star binary we've seen before electromagnetically. So that at least proves that such massive neutron stars or such massive bodies, because we can't prove they're neutron stars, do form binaries and do merge, which is something we didn't know from galactic observations. But here is, which is where things start becoming problematic, because if you don't have perfect proof from the masses anymore that it's a neutron star binary, the tidal interactions are not going to save you anymore, because tidal interactions are intrinsically weaker for more massive objects. This has nothing to do with the properties of neutron star matter or the equation of state or nuclear matter. This is just a simple fact. If something's more compact, it's more difficult to distort it. So more massive stars have intrinsically weaker tidal interactions. So here's an example of this. How this laid out for 1904-25. This is the measurement for the tidal parameter of 1904-25. And those lines here are upper limit for how big the tidal interactions could be. Well, this orange curve is where we expected it to be. Given the masses, what we think was the plausible values for this parameter, so that's a physically interesting region, and our upper limits are not competitive. You can translate this to a radius, and we had this number in the paper, and it was something like 17, 18 kilometers. So not competitive with anything else we know about neutron stars.
So, question, maybe you can repeat. So this assumes that your plot of mass to radius, as you change the mass, the radius stays fairly constant. So if it runs, if it changes, it could have the same impact on lambda, right?
Oh, the orange, you mean?
No, so your observation that as you go to higher masses, it's higher, it's more difficult to see tidal effects. That's under the assumption that the radius doesn't change with the mass. So,
Yes, but even with equation. Oh, yes, sorry. The question was that the conclusion that as you increase the mass, the tidal interactions go down. Is based on an equation of state with an almost constant radius that shoot up in mass radius. This is the most probably straightforward regime to see, but it also holds for equation of state with phase transitions. So if you have any sudden softening of the equation of state, it's going to cause the same effect. I've seen select cases of very fine-tuned models where you can, for some small mass range, you can maybe break the trend and have lambda increase for a little bit and then decrease again. But it's the exception. Okay, so for heavier systems, things are more complicated. So if you have something that's 1.8, 1.9 solar masses, it's hard to measure any tidal interactions. And that's going to be the case, unfortunately, for quite a while. So these are simulated data that show for a total mass of 3.2. So this is actually slightly smaller mass than 1904-25, but still it's a very heavy neutron star binary. And this has, because it is quite heavy, it has a relatively small amount of tidal interactions. And this is analyzed with upcoming instruments. So, upcoming back then, I guess. But O3 and O4 sensitivity, you get that neutron stars and black holes are indistinguishable because it means that the amount of tidal interactions that you infer is consistent with zero. You need something like third generation. So 1.6 plus 1.6. If you go to a heavier system, it's going to be even more of a grim picture. And even then, even if you do that, you can only prove that there is one neutron star, not two. So what happens when you get a two solar mass binary on 2.5? Maybe you measure some tidal interactions, but you still do not know anything about what happens with a 2.5 solar mass object. And we'll get to that in a bit again more. Okay, so, yes?
Sorry, does that mean that the previous plot for the 3G panel, if I plotted lambda 1 and lambda 2, I wouldn't be able to exclude 0 for both of them?
That's right.
Okay, so only on lambda tilde, they can exclude 0 for 3G.
That's right. And that's true also for today, if lambda tilde is larger. Okay. We should probably stop pretending that electromagnetic observations don't happen. They do, thankfully, and they can prove at least there's some matter involved in the system. But you can potentially go a step further, and that's all I'm going to say about it. If people are interested in talking about the systematics here more, I think it would be a nice topic for discussion. But you can also try to turn these statements into quantitative calculations. I guess I don't know what a non-quantitative calculation is, but okay. Some quantitative statement. So this is an example of what you can do possibly from the electromagnetic data by linking again the properties of the system to what was actually observed, with the argument here being that you need some amount of ejected mass to give rise to electromagnetic system, to the electromagnetic counterpart. And in order to have any amount of ejected mass, you need to avoid prompt collapse into a black hole, which means that you put a lower limit on the tidal parameter. So here is an example of how this works out and why this is fairly appealing. You have the gravitational wave data putting an upper limit on the tidal interactions. You have electromagnetic data with this argument putting a lower limit on the tidal interaction. So you get pushed by two sides, and that's sort of, you know, the best case scenario when you want to put constraints. The problem here is that the actual location of the red arrow, where exactly that lower limit is, depends on numerical simulations, and there's some debate about the exact location of this point. Okay, and then that brings us to the fourth bullet, which is the remnant star. The nature and the evolution of the remnant could also help you understand both the binary itself, which is the progenitor, but also the remnant and the environment around it acts as the initial conditions for any electromagnetic emission. So it is important for both gravitational wave and electromagnetic observers. And you can have different kind of scenarios for the merger remnant, at least for a neutron star binary. If you have prompt collapse into a black hole, the emission is your typical black hole ring down, which at least for, let's say, a black hole of 2.7 solar masses, falls at about 6,000 hertz, which is way too high for us to see. If you have long duration, in order to create long duration emission on the right side, you would need something like a long-lived neutron star, and here I'm talking about minutes or more, supported by its spin before it loses it and collapses to a black hole. And the in-between region is where you have this sort of metastable hypermassive neutron star that's supported with differential rotation for a little bit, and by a little bit, I mean, say tens of milliseconds, before it collapses to a black hole. So incidentally, at least for 17817, the middle seems to be the most likely scenario. There's a lot of argument that this is what happened, but this mostly comes from the electromagnetic observations. And that helps a little bit understand the nature of the binary better. So there's this argument that the electromagnetic observation itself needed the merger remnant to be a hypermassive neutron star. It couldn't collapse promptly to give rise to the GRB, and it couldn't be an energetic argument's disfavor a long-lived neutron star, otherwise it would have emitted too much energy. Which means that if this collapses into a hypermassive neutron star after a while, and you know the total mass from the gravitational wave, we measured that very well, that gives you an upper limit on the maximum mass of neutron stars. So the first calculation along this argument put a limit of 2.17, so solar masses. You can see that number, little number inside the figure I have from this paper. You might notice I wrote a different number outside the box of 2.3 because, again, this is where all sorts of systematics start creeping in, and there's lots of reanalysis and arguments about this, and they seem to, well, 2.3 is a more conservative number I could get from the multitude of papers that have looked into this argument. But this is a possibility that that makes use of electromagnetic data to argue about what the fate of the remnant star might have been. With gravitational wave data, the post-merger signal that would be emitted from such a hypermassive neutron star is less observable. It's quite high frequency. It's around 2,000 to 3,000 hertz. It's not very high amplitude, so it will be quite a while until we can actually observe it. But on the other hand, it's unlikely that ignoring it or not taking it into account would systematically bias our iron spiral constraints on the tidal deformability. So that's good. Once we get this, we can analyze it. We can extract some features from it, at least the main features, such as a dominant post-merger peak in the spectrum. But interpreting such a signal is a different story, and that's the point where you squarely are in the regime of needing external input and external help to understand the intricacies of numerical simulations and which predictions of the simulations about the morphology of the signal are robust or not. This is all I'm going to say about this. We can discuss this more, but since by my estimate, we won't see such a signal with gravitational waves for at least until 05, I'll move on. Okay. So far I've been telling you a little bit more about what we can do, maybe with a little bit of discussion of possible cracks in the picture. And now I'm gonna start basically telling you what we don't know. Here's a list of things, a list of arguments we're trying to make about to understand those observations and where I think there are uncertainties, and I would love to discuss all this more with you. So here is the masses of the inferred masses of a bunch of objects we think are probably neutron star black hole systems. So you'll see M1, the top axis, we're talking about 5, 10, 20 something solar masses. These are definitely black holes, right? This is easy. The mass of the secondary are in what we would probably call neutron star range, or maybe at the limits. So you have the blue and the orange, don't ask me for their names, I don't remember, which fall between 1 and 2 solar masses. So these are probably neutron stars. We can't prove it. You can't measure really any tidal interactions from those systems, and there was no electromagnetic counterpart. But if I give you a 1.7 solar mass object, you will most likely be okay calling this a neutron star. The problem is that there is this 2.6 solar mass object, and that I remember, that's 1908-14, which falls sort of where we would call the in-between region between neutron stars and black holes. This is where the question marks are, and it's either the lightest black hole or the heaviest neutron star. Again, absolutely no tidal interactions in the event, and no electromagnetic counterpart. So that's the point where we start really needing some external input about how to interpret a system like this. So the external input in this plot is given by the two green curves, the ones labeled M max, comma something. And there are two types of external input you can consider here. The first comes from equation of state constraints. We have some constraint of the equation of state of neutron stars. What are those constraints on the maximum mass? And the second is on galactic neutron stars that are observed at about 2 solar masses, so that gives you maybe an idea that the maximum mass might be around 2 solar masses. So let's talk about these two types of external information in more detail. So the first is galactic pulsars. Galactic neutron star binaries have masses around 1.3, but galactic pulsars in general, for the ones that we have mass measurements for, have a much wider mass range. So the blue here is a mass distribution of all pulsars in binaries that have a mass measurement, a reliable mass measurement. And we don't really observe many things above 2 solar masses, so there's possibly a cutoff at around 2 solar masses. That's the black line. So this is where this estimate for the maximum mass of neutron stars is coming from, which brings up the question, is that actually a fair comparison? Do the galactic pulsars have the same mass distribution, have the same properties as LIGO sources? And here, I'm not even talking about things like selection effects in the observations or technical other technical issues with the analysis like systematics, but fundamentally, do we actually expect LIGO sources to have the same mass distribution as galactic pulsars? Well, can already answer this, that the answer, can only know that the answer is no. Because at this point, with enough observations of neutron stars, we can put some constraints on the mass distribution. It does not look like the galactic one at all. So here, the dashed black, no, dashed dotted black and the solid black are the binary neutron stars in the galaxy and the adjusted neutron stars in the galaxy. And the orange and green are estimates for the mass distribution of neutron star-like objects, so objects between roughly one and two solar masses, even though we can't prove they're neutron stars, with gravitational waves. So this is an analysis done by actually Phil, who's in the room, and was published in the LVC paper on the population properties for GWGC3. And you can immediately see that they're not consistent. There's no sharp peak at around 1.3 solar masses, and we predict more heavy neutron stars, closer to two solar masses, 1.8, than you see in the galaxy. So it does not seem to be consistent. You could keep playing this game, looking at the masses and comparing them to what you, other information you have. Another thing to do is look for a possible dip, an idea first proposed by Maya, but also pursued with more events since then. And this is finally, actually, I think this is a plot from Amanda Farah's paper, the second paper in the list of references, that shows you the mass distribution of all events. You can see the x-axis from one low solar masses up to 10, so from what you would call the neutron star range all the way up to what you would call the black hole range. And the interesting thing is that, you know, of course, you have the black holes here, you have what you would call the neutron stars here, and there's a possible dip where you would traditionally say you have your observational low mass gap. It's not 100% settled whether there's actually a dip there, but there's a hint of a dip. But also the dip is not completely empty. You probably have an underdensity of events rather than a complete gap, which is also sort of what you were getting electromagnetically, because there are some objects that haven't been killed yet, and they are within the 3 to 5 solar mass range. This question? Yes.
Sorry, we know of GW17 or A17, we know the galaxy host. Mm-hmm. Is there anything or the smoking gun characteristic of GW994, whatever that galaxy was, and ours, that you could say, well, that's the event where you're sure they weren't binary stars, that we know the ones that we know in our galaxy? Is there anything that would try and say, this may be the reason why the population observed in our galaxy is different from this only event that we really know are binary stars, or at least there is one binary star?
So the question is about the observation of 17 or 817 and its host galaxy, that we know its host galaxy are, and how it relates to our galaxy?
Yeah, why would that give us something that would be different from our...
So 17 or 817 is not different. 17 or 817 is not the problem here. 17 or 817 is very consistent with what we have in our galaxy.
Okay.
The problem is all the other stuff.
Okay, and the other ones we don't have any gas. Okay.
Yeah, but also our galaxy is also not at all like 17 or 17's host, yeah.
Yeah, so what about the secondary black holes, so mergers? So if you merge two neutron stars and you form a black hole, that could be a potential contamination to your mass gaps. So how do you tackle that?
To which mass gap?
This.
To our mass gap? This is a mass gap in the mass distribution of merging events. So if you want those objects to somehow contaminate this result, we need an argument for how those objects actually participate in a second merger, which again brings us back to, we need a lot more external input from population synthesis. So can you actually, what are the rates for this? Some calculations about this that the rates are quite low, because if neutron star binaries are not formed in some sort of dense environment, but are formed in the field, the chance of the remnant finding another body is low. And sorry, I didn't repeat the question, probably figured out by context, but the question was what happens about the merger remnants that would leave in the gap?
And just to point out what I just maybe said, this is a fit in total mass distribution, so if there are two G1G mergers, they would be included in this model. Like, you don't need to do anything extra. This model is included.
So, do you
want to
repeat that?
Oh, sorry, yes. Reed pointed out that this is a fit to the total mass distribution. So those are included there, what the, those masses are.
What's the green line versus the lightning, the black lightning?
The green line versus the lightning. The black, sorry.
Maximum likelihood.
Thank you.
Maximum likelihood is the green. And so it, sorry, just it doesn't fall in the middle of the black lines because there's a strong prior preference for like smaller dips. And the data actually prefers a relatively sharp dip. And this is something that we had to think a lot about with our referee report. So that's why I know that. Sorry.
Thank you. Okay. So yeah, in case it wasn't obvious, Reed was also involved in this study, but it was probably obvious. Okay, so going back then to external information, you need to interpret some of those objects. The second external information you might have comes from equation of state constraints and what the maximum mass of neutron stars can be there from nuclear considerations. So going back to this plot, there's a plot on the top that compares the maximum mass as what you get from the equation of state, which is the dashed, the black, which is from neutron stars in the galaxy, and the two colored ones coming from gravitational waves. So far, everything seems to be consistent, but with large uncertainties. And this is where we have to think a little bit more about what goes into these calculations and how you infer the maximum mass from nuclear physics constraints. But once you have it, this can be quite powerful because you can also use it to make some statements about what those objects you have are. So here's a plot from a study from Reed and Phil with the mass of 1904-25 and 1908-14. So 1908-14 at the top is the 2.6 solar mass one. 1904-25 is probably intrastar binary, but quite heavy. You can see the masses on the x-axis. And then you compare that to what you have from external information about the maximum mass coming from equation of state studies. So this is the y-axis. And 1904-25 looks perfectly consistent with a neutron star, no problem. But 1908-14, if it's a neutron star, it has to be a spinning neutron star. Again, going back to our theme where that the spins of neutron stars are unmeasurable, but will come in and ruin everything. And just as a side note, when you're doing this sort of analysis, the maximum mass coming from equation of state constraints tell you how big neutron stars are. So if you interpret anything below that as a neutron star, you assume there's no neutron star black hole overlap in the mass distribution, which different people have different degrees of comfort with this assumption, let's say. Okay.
How large should the spin be?
Sorry?
How large would this, should the spin have to be?
For 1908-14?
Yep.
Oh, so the between the dashed and the solid, you increase the neutron star spin.
Right, and so how large effectively would that spin be?
Well, you have to integrate this whole thing, but yeah, go ahead.
Right, so Luis asked how big does the spin have to be for the fire in the avocado fire plot? And so the answer is like 0.4, 0.5. Okay. So consistent with the neutron star, like the breakup frequency for neutron stars is included here.
But probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, the problem is, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Phil from the back shouts out that it has to be a lot faster than any known millisecond pulsar, but it's not ruled out on like causality or basic physical grounds. Like
or Keplerian limit, yeah.
But then what I'm perhaps thinking, based on that, you can also estimate that it has the, whatever angular moment magnetic field might have should be very low.
Yeah.
Or should be very aligned, because otherwise, how would you get such a large spin still there?
Yeah.
Okay. That's another thing, that the spin can save you in some cases, but also the relation between the maximum mass and the spin is quite steep at high spin. So low spins between 1.1 and 1.2, 1.3 are not going to increase the maximum mass too much. You need large spin for this argument to actually work. And then you run into other issues. Okay, so we have all those issues about spins and how to interpret them, but there's actually another concern here. We need external information about the maximum mass. So let's talk a little bit about where this is coming from. So here's an example of some constraints on the equation of state with different data. So this is the pressure in neutron stars, a function of density. And you have lines that represent, including different amounts of, that represent your constraints after including different data. And this, by the way, I just point out, is done with a non-parametric model for the equation of state based on a Gaussian process. And you can sort of see that different data have very different, qualitatively different impact on your constraints. So if you look at the blue, these are labeled as pulsars. These are the heavy pulsars we have observed. We observed two solar mass pulsars, so we know that those things exist. So we know that the equation of state needs to be stiff enough, the pressure needs to be high enough to support those, which pushes the constraints up from the black to the light blue. Gravitational waves, I've been saying, put an upper limit on the tides and on the pressure inside neutron stars, so they push you down from the blue to the green, and X-ray observations push you from the green to the blue. So all this is really nice, very nice constraints, very nice data, but you might notice that I've plotted all those arrows at very different points along the x-axis, which is because all those different constraints give you information about very different regimes inside the neutron star. So when you talk about the maximum mass, it mostly tells you about what happens at the center of the star, because that's where most mass is. So you care about the conditions at the center of the star. When you talk about radius from the X-ray observations or tides from gravitational waves, those mostly affect what happens in the slightly more outer layers of the star. That makes sense. When you're looking for how big an object is, you care about what happens in the outer layers. That's where volume is. So you're looking at the outer layers. And though not included here, if you also consider things like nuclear theory or terrestrial experiments, they even go to slightly lower densities below the nuclear saturation density. So if you have to combine all those constraints, and out of these comes an estimate for the maximum mass that we can use to interpret our systems that we observe with gravitational waves, you have to find a way to connect all those measurements across very different density scales, and that's what brings you to the point of what model for the equation of state do you use to do that, and what impact does that model have for your inference. So here is an example showing this effect exactly. So the blue one is the result with a non-parametric equation of state, and all the other colors are results with phenomenological parametric models for the equation of state we commonly use. So spectral, piecewise polytrop, and speed of sound parameterization. And what happens here, there's a lot of stuff going on, but the thing to focus on is the following little thought experiment. Let's say we got a very precise constraint on the equation of state at one density and one density only. This is where those arrows are. In this case, you would expect you only have data for what happens in this density. You want to be constrained only in this density. And this is sort of what the blue does. You have tight constraints and then it opens up. But, and that's a more flexible approach, but more phenomenological models will put additional constraints in other density ranges. And those constraints depend on the model, depend on the functional form of the model, which is what we've termed as correlations between different density scales. So this is if you put a constraint in some density scale, that propagates in other density scales due to correlations imposed by the model. And that will propagate all the way to your maximum mass constraints, because most of our data, we have the pulsars which give you a lower limit on the maximum mass, but we don't have a lot of data about what happens on the other side of the maximum mass, what's an upper limit on the maximum mass. And we have a lot of data about what happens at low densities. So how do all these propagate to the maximum mass? So here's an example for this. This is the maximum mass, so a very high density probe of neutron stars, versus the radius of a 1.4 solar mass neutron star, so a fairly low density probe of neutron stars. So think of it a little bit as high densities versus low densities. And this is the prior and the posterior after you include all your data from the more non-parametric, more flexible analysis and a parametric phenomenological model, specifically the spectral equation of state, and look at the maximum mass. So we all put a lower limit on the maximum mass. That makes sense because we've seen objects there. Has to be above about 2. But on the high side of the maximum mass, we still put constraints on it. In this analysis, we have no data that actually inform what the upper limit on the maximum mass is. So where does this constraint come from? And I'm talking about the difference up here between a prior, but the posterior goes down, so something informed that.
Could you perhaps use the mouse to find
Nope, I don't see it here. Do you see it? No. I don't know why, but it doesn't appear. But I'm talking about the difference between the prior and the posterior at around 2.8 solar masses. Okay. So let's see what happens here. So look at the two-dimensional plot, the maximum mass and the radius. The priors don't extend in this entire region. The priors are the dashed lines. They don't extend in the entire region. They sort of, the blue at least, truncates close to that black line. That black line is causality. We know there has to be some correlation between low and high densities in the neutron stars because the speed of sound in neutron stars cannot be above the speed of light. So that excludes roughly some region here. It's plotted more sharply than it actually is. There's some uncertainty there. But that excludes that region. And that black puts some that black region puts some constraints on the maximum mass. So here's the black arrow at the top plot pushing you down a little bit from the prior to the posterior. But on top of this, the orange one is pushed even further down. And that is what is due to modeling uncertainty in the equation of state, because your specific phenomenological model cannot access the entire allowed physical region, and that's due to just constraints on how the model was constructed in its functional form, which puts additional upper bound on the maximum mass, saying that now it's slightly lower than what predicted from the blue. So that's an additional source of uncertainty to consider here when we want to understand how to use the maximum mass coming from those equation of state constraints. We need to understand how the low density data we have about the equation of state propagate to high densities, or what they imply for those high densities and the maximum mass of neutron stars. Okay, on this issue, on the various issues of what the models do for you, this is not just an issue of how things propagate from low to high densities. It's also an issue of what happens at low densities. So here's the radius of a 1.4 solar mass neutron star and the tidal parameter of a 1.4 solar mass neutron star. With gravitational waves, we measure tidal parameters. So let's say you get a perfect measurement for this, say a delta function, a perfect detector, or the best binary ever, gives you a very precise constraint on this parameter, you still have some uncertainty in the radius based on modeling, and different models would have some uncertainty in the radius of a different magnitude. So with gravitational waves, we actually measure this lambda. How you convert it to the radius, again, brings in issues of model systematics. I don't see any clock anywhere. How much time is there left?
You get about 10 minutes.
Okay. In this case, I'm going to, skip a couple of problems. Talk about this problem. Other issue. What is the mass distribution of neutron stars? We don't know it. We usually assume that things are decoupled between masses and equation of state. But that's actually not true. If you assume the wrong mass distribution, you will bias your results. This is an example from a study led by Dan Wysocki, where if you assume the wrong mass distribution for what the neutron stars are and you fix it, you will end up getting a bias in your inferred parameters for the equation of state after about 50 events. Again, 50 is large, it's not where we are. We are actually closer to 1 to 2 events. So that effect is small today, but going forward, we'll have to grapple with this. But also other questions that are more again, qualitative in nature, other than inferring the neutral star mass distribution. But for example, we don't really know whether the neutral star masses we observe are limited by astrophysics, which means the supernova physics that form neutron stars through stellar evolution, or they're limited by nuclear physics. That's something that we don't know. We make strong assumptions about it. Thankfully, it doesn't really affect things right now. You can see the different, the results from assuming three different things about this. But going forward, it will start becoming more and more influential. And by the way, this goes both ways. If you also try to infer the neutron star mass distribution, ignoring finite size effect, ignoring tides, assuming the wrong equation of state, you will get a bias. This is plotted here, so you have the dotted, are the correct mass distributions. Again, this is simulated data, and they inferred in shaded regions, and you'll see that they're not really very well consistent, and that is due to ignoring equation of state. So you have to do all that stuff together. By the way, if this sounds counterintuitive to you, or no, not counterintuitive, if that sounds weird to you, given how small the finite size effects are, it also sounded very weird to me when I first heard about it, but it has to be because of this. So this is the mass ratio and tidal parameter for 170817. And it's more pronounced for high spins, less so for low spins, but they are still a little bit correlated. So getting the wrong distribution for lambda tilde will also affect your mass ratio, which could propagate down to your mass distribution constraints. So unfortunately, it's all related, and even with a spin to some extent here. It's another problem. Another problem, I want to talk a little bit about the data, because we discussed this a lot with H-naught, how we calibrate the data. With neutron stars, we actually have a lot of issues with data quality, and we'll continue having issues. First of all, GW170817 overlapped. You see the track here, the really beautiful chirp track, overlapped with a monster overflow glitch in the detector. And this will continue happening, and it will happen basically every time you see a binary neutron star. We've seen two so far, they both overlapped with a glitch. This is not unlucky, this is just numbers. Glitches happen once a minute. Those signals last for 2 minutes. You know, do the math. Unfortunately, we will continue getting binary neutron star signals overlapping with glitches. There is a number of techniques to mitigate this. So here's a few examples. Maybe look at the top, an example of a black hole binary actually overlapping with a scattered light glitch. And you can separate the two, but you'd have to do something similar if you end up having a binary neutron star, when you end up having more binary neutron stars and they inevitably overlap with glitches, and you have to control systematics there. And on the topic of systematics with gravitational wave data, brings us back full circle to what we're discussing with H-naught about data calibration. Our detectors are not perfectly calibrated. There is some uncertainty, so those plots here show you the uncertainty in the calibration in amplitude and phase from O3A, and you see you have those envelopes that hopefully bracket the error. So we have to assume that the calibration is correct, the zero in those figures is placed correct, and also that the error bars are reliable. So that's one thing. There's an additional source of systematic uncertainty that you have to include in the analysis, but also if this calibration uncertainty is large, at some point you end up limiting how well you can measure things. And there's a plot from a very nice recent paper from Reed here that shows that if the, of course, as you would probably expect, if the calibration uncertainty is large, dominates, at that point you will end up basically not caring about how loud of a signal you get. Your constraints will be limited by calibration. Thankfully, that happens for very high SNRs. So the plot in the top, so the x-axis here is the SNR. So look, we're talking about high SNRs, so that's good. But we want to reach those high SNRs, at least with third generation detectors. And the plot here shows you the uncertainty in the Talit parameters. If you have no calibration uncertainty, the statistical uncertainty scale is just 1 over the SNR. That's the black line. It goes just straight down. But if you have a large calibration error, so in this direction of the arrows, the calibration gets worse and worse, at some point you plateau. You can no longer keep measuring things better and better, no matter how the SNR increases. So if we're at around 1% calibration uncertainty, we are limited at around this point. So this line is 1% calibration uncertainty. So we are limited to measuring the Talit parameters to a few, which is still great, but that's our limit. Okay, the final thing I wanted to say was something I will only very briefly mention because it's a very important topic. And because it's very important, we have a whole talk about it. And that's waveform modeling. That's probably the biggest source of uncertainty. We talk about calibration, we talk about equation of state modeling and all those things. Probably or certainly the first systematic we're gonna hit is waveform modeling. And Geraint will tell us all about this tomorrow. But just to say, for now, I want to say that different models seem to give consistent results, but we need to figure out how models are gonna break down. Because in the future, in a very near future, if you have a slightly higher signal to noise ratio, so in these plots, these are simulated signals where the strength of the signal increases from top to bottom and the tides, the amount of tile interaction increases from left to right. And as you see, as you go to stronger signals and larger tile interactions, you start getting differences between different models. So just in a few years, GW17087, a design sensitivity, we had an SNR of 10. It was a very lucky event, so we'll probably not get another one at design sensitivity, but if we did, its interpretation would be pretty much completely reliant on waveform systematics. And we have a whole talk about this tomorrow.
So, so here you're comparing four different waveform models and the impact on whatever
yeah.
you're tracking?
Yeah, so you have a simulated signal.
Was this an arc theory now?
100.
Does this sound okay?
Yeah. 25 and 100. So at 100, this is why I'm saying GW17817 and design sensitivity, at 100, if lambda is large, it's completely different. But even if lambda is small to what you sort of expect it to be, you get different answers from different waveform models. And that study is a few years back. So hopefully Geraint tomorrow will tell us about all the much improved models since then as well. There was another question, yeah.
So it looks like the EOB NR tidal and the non-NR tidal agree in all cases. Is that because the NR tidal model was the same?
Yeah, basically.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, oh, sorry, yes. So in all cases, the blue and, sorry, not the blue, the green and the red, which are the phenom DNR tidal and the CBNR, ROM and our tidal, agree quite well with each other. That is because they have the exact same treatment of tidal effects. But they have different treatment of the binary black hole baseline, and things could actually break down both in the baseline, the black hole baseline, and the treatment of tidal effects. So it's quite a complicated problem, of course. Okay, so I want to end here with this nice plot again, so that can make everyone optimistic about the future and just make everyone again pessimistic about the future, is that everything we want to say about all that stuff depends on a lot of astrophysics assumptions, where we need extra input from the astrophysics community, also the nuclear physics community, analysis limitations, such as what you do with a calibration of the detector, but also model systematics, either in the equation of state, the waveforms, issues with the calibration, et cetera. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Katerina. Are there any other questions? Great talk. Let's go in the back.
Hi, thank you for the nice talk. I had a question about one of your slides in which you were mentioning a pro from GW19-04-25 that there's a pro that we now know that massive bodies can form binaries. And from what I got was astronomically, these massive bodies forming binaries has not been seen, and that's why that was a pro. But is there any astrophysical limitation also which prevents massive bodies from forming binaries, or were we just waiting for an observation to show us that, yeah, that is also possible?
Yeah, it's a great question, because these are the kind of things, unfortunately, we can't help understanding what the different surveys do and the astrophysics and the different surveys. So yes, since this result, all these sort of interpretations have been explored, whether there's a real astrophysical reason why those bodies don't form, whether binaries don't form, or whether there's a selection effect. They form, but they merge too quickly for you to see them electromagnetically in the galaxy. Or you have some selection effect towards more massive bodies, observational selection effect, other observational selection effect against those bodies. So all these have been explored. The answer is we still don't fully understand this. But we definitely know that there's a difference, not just 19 of 425, but besides this, we've also seen other heavier neutron stars. Okay. More than you would expect from the galaxy, from the galactic distribution.
Okay, thank you. And I just had one quick question. The monster glitch that you showed, is this like a terrestrial glitch or an astrophysical glitch?
Oh, sorry, this is an instrumental artifact. Okay. So the detectors glitch, the rate in O3 was about once a minute. Okay. They have different origins. Some are known, some are unknown. But the problem is, as you improve the sensitivity of the detector, you reduce the noise level, which means more and more glitches that were below the noise level emerge above the noise level. Mm-hmm. So this argument says that the problem will get worse, but at the same time, people try to remove them. So, you know, there's a lot of mitigation effort going on. So these are instrumental artifacts.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so thanks, Katerina. One thing I want to add about what can go wrong, which you have not listed, something we have looked with Sylvia and Colin recently, and it's the effect of assumption on the spin distribution of neutron stars on the maximum mass. Because right now in DLVK papers, we are not marginalizing that explicitly out. People correct me if I'm wrong. So that means we are basically assuming that the distribution of neutron star spins in the universe is the same as the P prior, which, you know, probably is not true. And what we found is that that can have a pretty significant impact on the inference on the maximum mass. And more importantly, that it's gonna hit us after as few as 20, 30 BNSs, not hundreds. So it's something that as a community we should, and as DLVK, I guess, soon, we should start explicitly implementing our analysis. And because, you know, as also you showed there, right now we are giving out results pretty much either up to 0.05 or black holes, 0.9. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 0.05 is, you know, reasonable, but not a magic number. Spins can be a bit higher than that. And also, since Reed mentioned that the plot on the paper with Reed and the Phil, the one with the fire.
Avocado.
The other one is an avocado. I'm not the only one, right? We saw an avocado on the left. Yeah, it is. Was that in purpose, Phil? Yeah. It was. Raising purpose.
Yeah, so just to comment on, I agree with everything Sawa said. One update about what the LVK does is that we do actually marginalize over things like the mass distribution when we quote these probabilities and stuff like that. And it's very straightforward to include a marginalization over uncertainty and spin distribution. Sawa was correct that we haven't explicitly included that in what we published so far. But like the technology exists, and as their paper shows, we should do that.
You mean this result?
In the NSBH paper, and I think actually in 1908-14 detection paper, we marginalized over, maybe not in the best way, but we did marginalize over mass.
Right, right. I mean, when you try to estimate whether this event is above or below, is how consistent it is with the maximum mass, you do include the mass distribution.
Yeah, so this way of plotting it is not the easiest way to see that. That's why there's like the cartoon shading. But yes, you can, the numbers that we come out of this paper include mass distribution.
Right, but for Salva is right. In the mass distribution, that's where you just model the mass distribution. Spins are currently not included.
I mean, technically, standard is correct. So if one cares about the max, you have to include the spins in your inference.
Yeah. So there was a follow-up study after. So this analysis, Phil wrote a paper first proposing this analysis here, and that technique was applied in the LVC paper. And shortly after, there was another analysis that also looked at doing the full mass and spin modeling. And the answer, exactly because of this argument that the spin and the mass ratio are very correlated, and the answer ended up being quite the same, but that's because we only have like six objects here, because you also have the neutron stars with black holes. But eventually, yes, this needs to be taken into account as well.
Okay, question.
Question online, you can unmute yourself and ask, please.
Oh, hi, thank you. Thank you for the great talk. I guess I had a question that was a bit of a follow-on from Salvo's question, read these spins. So it was mentioned, read the previous plot, that spins up to, say, Keplerian breakup would be considered when trying to constrain the maximum mass. I guess from an astrophysical perspective, and this may be naive, but if we have a neutron stars, well, any rotating fluid body, they're going to be unstable to either secular or dynamical fluid instabilities, such that they will radiate away gravitational waves until spinning at a much slower rate. When you consider these binaries where there hasn't been like kind of much accretion for a very long time, it's more than likely that that these neutron stars wouldn't be able to be rotating that quickly because they would have long previously radiated away in gravitational waves through either like kind of bar modes or something similar until rotating much more slowly. Is there any way that this can be taken into account in the analysis? Or I guess, are there scenarios in which we would expect fluid bodies to be unstable to these sorts of instabilities for a very long time, but perhaps for whatever reason not radiating away, maybe through tidal forces or something else.
Yeah, to the extent of that much that incorporating the entire astrophysical argument, no. But this is sort of the motive. Astrophysical considerations are sort of the motivation between the orange and the blue curves here on the right side that do it for two different spins. The motivation here is that neutron star neutron star binaries in the galaxy will have a very small spin by the time they reach the LIGO band, but that the argument here is mostly based on, as Louis said, we're talking about high spins, about magnetic fields. So far, the only thing that we have, that as far as I know, the only thing that has been done is looking at those different cutoffs in the spin, whether you have as high as possible or low. But Salva's point is that as high as possible still assumes flat up to as high as possible, which is almost definitely not true. Well, definitely not true. So you need to model this in more detail. But so far, no. We've only done sharp cutoffs in the spin.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. So maybe related to this previous question, there is a work that Reid and collaborators did a few years ago with, you have these fluid instabilities that can drive some non-trivial interactions. And so maybe at some point you want to say something about that. My question was, so once you kind of speculate that what would happen if you have an SNR of 100, so I'm curious if you guys also took a look at what would be the residual SNR on the post-merger event, and if that thing were to last long enough, maybe that gives you an R handle in the system, or you didn't look into that?
So you mean what the post-merger would look like when you have SNR 100 in the in-spiral?
Because that will give me another handle on the problem. Even if I didn't have good enough templates to begin with,
yeah,
that gives me another independent way that is cleaner, and then I can come and inform back.
Right. So when you want to calculate post-merger SNRs, we're going back into the numerical simulations and how much you trust the amplitude coming from those. But assuming from the ones I've seen, you need the in-spiral SNR would correspond to something like 300 to 400, the point where the post-merger starts becoming detectable. Again, plus or minus a lot. Yeah.
So I can
hopefully, okay. I just quick follow-up to what Luis mentioned about dynamical other types of tidal instabilities. Grant and Patricia have a great paper about this, and Grant's talking about sort of this stuff tomorrow, so we can come back to that. But it's definitely something that we're gonna have to worry about with these odd signals. Okay. Any other questions for Katarina at the moment? Worries, concerns, opportunities, excitement?
Are you more pessimistic or more optimistic than an hour ago?
Both.
Yes.
I guess when do we have to start considering uncertainties in like population census models? I mean, there's like nice things by Paul Brokaw. She seems to think that the neutral sum mass distribution for the DNS is like the different kinds of behaviors. When can we start using this sort of information in this way?
Right. So the question was, when we can start, do we need to worry more about population synthesis uncertainties? And for example, whether the neutron star distribution in neutron star binaries is different than the one in neutron star black hole binaries. I don't know the answer to this. I can't give you a number. But if I had to guess, I would say that when it comes to population synthesis, usually everything is more data-driven. So when we have the data to separate between the two, then the theory will more follow. But the theory could give you a sort of inspiration to look for this effect. But traditionally, mostly with population synthesis, it mostly goes the other way. You go from the data to the theory.
Can I comment on that? Great. I think that's a great question. I think the time to start doing it is now already. For one example, there are predictions for the mass ratios of NSBHs from PopSynth. In LIGO, we typically assume some power law in, you know, mass ratio pairing. I think that's wrong. I think that's completely wrong. And I think there's a specific prediction from the PopSynth side that we could be using as a prior. And I think it's actually borne out by the few observations we have so far.
Yeah, but at what point will using a power law actually bias you? Because you have, what, 4 neutron stars from NSBHs right now, or 3?
Depends if you want the, if you count the sub-threshold ones. But I think we're getting closer, right?
Okay.
I was going to say that we shouldn't use population synthesis as priors because...
Should or shouldn't?
Should not.
Okay.
Like, to me, like, the reason why I'm in this business is because we can do the measurements without using that as a prior. Because, I mean, I'm biased because I'm in the field, but the outcome of PopSynth seems to be strongly dependent on the code, on the time of when you ask the answer, on what we have detected in gravitational wave meanwhile, and so on and so forth. So, you know, that's great. We should compare maybe nodes and plot them in the same plot. But I don't think we should. I think we should be extremely careful in using that as prior. Even the great work by Floor, right, where she has this massive and beautiful plot with how the rates depend on the knobs on you know, the PopSync code. That's great. It's still varying one parameter at a time, so neglecting correlation between parameters. It's a good first crack, but I think we are years away from anything that we should bet more than a coffee on.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would say maybe it's not so much about using priors that are directly informed by the PopSynth, but allowing PopSynth maybe to inform our kinds of phenomenological models we use,
yeah,
right?
That's fair.
So, you know, we pick a power law in mass ratio pairing. Maybe we should be picking a Gaussian in mass ratio, because that is a generic thing that seems to come out of the PopSynth.
Yeah, but then the counter argument to that would be that, so I agree with you, first of all. But so I think what I would do always, meaning the LVK or short order work, always use at least two models, because if your results depends on your model more than something, it means your result is weak in the first place, so you shouldn't believe it too much.
But our results are weak.
I mean, we're already in that situation in which we're highly spin dependent, so I guess certainly I completely agree with everything that's been said about population synthesis models and the uncertainties in population synthesis models, that they're huge at the end of the day. I guess it's certainly in the BBH case, we started moving towards the astrophysical prior for how we present some of our results. And when can we start doing this with perhaps neutron stars? And when does it become important when you're dealing with perhaps a BNS or an NSBH and these sorts of questions?
So can I add something to this Katerina discussion? Mm-hmm. I like that we plot, you know, our measurements against the Gaussian distribution of neutron stars. At the same time, why would we expect them to be comparable in the first place? I mean, look what happened to the black hole distributions, right? The mass distribution. For the galactic X-ray binaries, it stopped at 10, 15. So, you know, I like the plot, but like, why would we expect in the first place to be at all related, right?
Well, Phil might
it's
have
Phil's
a reason,
fault.
But I'm gonna...
But,
yeah, the reason...
I don't think we necessarily expect them to be the same, but this is, you know, the galactic observations are other observations of double neutron star systems. And I think this touches on something Luis asked during the talk, which is like, do we have an explanation for why we saw 1904-25 in gravitational waves when we see nothing like it galactically? I think the standard story is something Katerina touched on, this fast merging channel. So the standard story that's offered is there is unstable mass transfer, you know, in some systems that produces binary neutron stars that merge extremely fast that aren't around long enough to be observed in the radio. I think that's a plausible story. I think by, you know, I think what you want to do is construct a joint model that has the two evolutionary pathways and can ultimately tie things back to a common birth mass distribution. There's been work on this by the Osgrav group, and I think that's the way forward. But I think as the starting point, you know, you have to make the observation that, look, the distributions are indeed different, so you need this extra step in the model.
Right, and there's another difference with black holes, is that here we're in desperate need of external input for how to interpret those events. You can say it's useful to compare the X-ray binary distribution to our black holes, but there isn't some information from those binaries that we desperately need to understand our binary black hole systems. Here, there is. We need to understand the maximum mass better because we cannot interpret systems like this or objects like this. So we need to understand what the other predictions are and what they depend on.
And just to add on top of that, the types of constraints that we can use this external input to place are really just ruling out the possibility of a neutron star. We can't ever really rule out the possibility of a black hole, because the way you would do that is with, like Katerina said, the tidal effects, and we can't see those tidal effects. They're too small exactly for these systems. So it's more of a statement that no, it's not a neutron star, than like, yes, it is a black hole.
So I didn't talk about it. I had to skip some stuff, but I also wanted to bring up something like this. We don't spend too much time thinking about this, but if there is a 2 solar mass black hole, or if there is a 1.9 solar mass black hole, yes, we won't be able to tell it apart from a neutron star. But if there is a 1.9 solar mass black hole, why wouldn't there be also a subsolar mass black hole? And we're searching for this. We can tell them apart from neutron stars. So if there's a non-astrophysical formation pathway for low mass black holes, there is a mass regime where we could clearly identify them, tell them apart from neutron stars, and at least that gives us an indication. If you detect something here, then of course you start becoming worried for the entire mass range. But if you don't detect anything here, that's promising. So I think the subsolar mass search is actually quite interesting. It could have implications for the neutron stars as well.
Okay. Are there any other questions? We're going to have more discussion after coffee. All right, let's give Katerina a huge hand.
Thank you, everyone.